Good afternoon and welcome. I want to thank y'all for coming. My name is Rick McClellan. Regardless of what the program says, I go by my middle name. The world has yet to allow me to do that on anything official. But I insist I will keep trying forever. I have a couple jobs today. One of them I'm going to introduce Matt, and the other one is to keep Matt on time. The first one is easy. The second one is impossible. I've been Matt's boss for about 7 years, and it's really interesting when you are when you have somebody who is what I would call a world's expert in something who works for you, and you're responsible for it. So Matt tries to keep me straight. When I talk to him, he says, "What do you want me to say about you when I introduce you?" And he said, "Well, read my book." I have started to read his book. As I started reading it, I came to one conclusion. Without saying it, he kind of asserts that wargaming began with cavemen drawing on the sides of caves, figuring out how they were going to catch tomorrow's lunch, or today's lunch as it could be. He doesn't say that. He doesn't take a perspective. But there's an insinuation in there. So Matt's done this, and he started thinking about wargaming even before he was out of high school, because he designed some wargames in high school. Professionally, he has taught wargaming at the Air Force's Air Command and Staff College. He's worked in Checkmate for the Air Force, and now he's with the Air Force Research Lab at Wright-Patt as part of our wargaming team. And Matt, in that capacity, Matt is not only, he's teaching wargaming to the Air Force and the other services and mentoring our younger folks that are coming on, because Matt and I are both getting along in years. We're not quite where Professor Saban is, where we're going to retire, but we're close. And I'm also challenging him to take wargaming into the future, where we're going. We have to do things a little bit different than what we have, because there are a lot of folks that are skeptical about it. But Matt is very key to that effort. So without further ado, I will introduce Matt Cafferty to talk about his book on wargaming.
Sir, thank you so much.
Thanks,
appreciate
Matt.
It, sir. All righty. Well, this is going to be a challenge, particularly for, try to meet your boss's expectations and being done in 45 minutes. Is going to be a tough expectation to meet. Basically, what I'm going to try to do, the reason for today, you may think you're here to learn a little lecture about the book. What my reason for today is to get some insights to the next book. And most of you should have these index cards. I'm not sure how fast I can run through the book. So the index cards serve two purposes. One, I can get your input. We're almost at 45 minutes when I'm done. But then two, a lot of times when I would be teaching Air Command Staff College, the most insightful comment would be from a student who spoke last, who wasn't going to speak at all, but I'd go, "Gee, I haven't heard from you." And it would be the most insightful comment of the whole conversation. And sometimes when you're trying to get feedback from folks, you're getting feedbacks from the ones that are not shyness challenge and not necessarily the most valuable. So I'm going to zoom through this as fast as I can. Now, since I'm zooming through this, you also have the opportunity to say, I've read the book and you comment on this, but you don't really completely explain this. Can you go into more depth? And so that's yet another reason why I'm going to try to get through the book in less than 45 minutes. And then, it's good that you're going to write who to add and stuff like that, but we can have a discussion about what I should do next. Because I kind of can do A, B, or A and B, and that is to do just an updated edition of the book, do something with a new title that's significantly different, or maybe do both in time. But we'll get to that in a minute. So let's go forward. So disclaimer, this is, my boss has not approved the slides or the book. It went through security and policy review a long time ago, but that doesn't make it Air Force doctrine. This is all my views and should not be confused with people who give me money every 2 weeks. And then here's, I think, some of why what we're doing is so very important. In the United States, there's a lot of talk about the second offset strategy, how smart weapons improved reconnaissance and communications, stealth technology really gave us a qualitative edge over adversaries. Well, smart weapons are proliferating around the world. Now, for decades, people have been worried about nuclear proliferation, and rightly so, but proliferation of smart weapons and things like that are also very important. We're seeing the rise of net peers, and I think this is something that Great Britain can identify with. Great Britain is more powerful, richer, has more national strength than at any point in its existence. But you guys were the superpower for the globe. You never fell, just other nations started to catch up. And other nations are starting to catch up with us in coalitions of nations. So we need to up our game. We need to box above our weight because we seem to be eerily similar to you guys a few decades back. At least that's the direction we seem to be going. Okay, it's been a quarter of a century since Peter Perlow's book. If you haven't seen Peter Perlow's book, it's still worth reading today. But it was turned into the publisher in 1989. A lot of history has happened since then, and there's been a lot of advancement in the thought on wargaming too. And a lot of old history has been declassified and found. So there's stuff in this book that's like, that actually happened. And then finally, a lot of stuff that wasn't available to Dr. Perlow, I got. In some cases, I got it from Dr. Perlow. So kind of an update. My boss kind of went through the background a little bit. I am younger than the Jurassic period, but I've been doing this for a long time. I like to tell people I designed my first war game in 1966. I was in eighth grade at the time, but even so, I've been at this for a bit. School of Advanced Air Power Studies, and then I think most people know about Checkmate. It's the strategy cell in the basement of the Pentagon, and commercial war games actually helped me in that to get accepted there. And then I was a co-author once before, and lots of articles. So basically what we're going to do is divide this into three parts, and we're going to talk about the early wargaming from the eclipse after World War II to the eclipse after the Gulf Strike and up to the present, and then a little bit about what I covered at the end. Now the reason that this is organized this way, I think you saw this in the program. AFRO does a lot of research into aerodynamics and stuff like that. So you can take a wing shape and you can put it in a wind tunnel, and you can vary the speed of the wing, the wind, and all the rest. Well, that doesn't work for astronomy. You can't put Jupiter, in a test tube. It doesn't work for meteorology. You can't put a hurricane into a lab. What those fields do is they test their hypotheses against observed data. Well, in the case of wargaming, observed data is called history. So learning that history is very, very helpful. And one of the things that I'm hoping shows up on some of these white cards is particularly cases when somebody did a wargame on a contingency, and then the contingency actually happened. That's called out specifically in the book, and hopefully that can tell us some of the capabilities and limitations, any use that shows capability and limitation. Then another thing that I want to hope gets into the cards is invention's important. Having the electric light is kind of a useful thing, and we kind of leave out, you guys did arc lights before us, so we tend to think of Thomas Edison, but he did invent a lot of stuff. And he's very well known. Well, if war games really are as important as I think most of us in the room think they are, then aren't the people who advanced war gaming worthy of being remembered, at least by other war gamers? And so one of the things the book tries to do is mention those people who really moved the ball forward. Well, if I'm missing any of those people, I don't want to miss any of those people. And I don't know British war gaming or Canadian wargaming, or Dutch wargaming, as well as I know American wargaming. So that's another area where I very much want your input. Okay. So the introduction starts off with what I try to make sound like a narrative, an actual event of an armored column going through a city and getting ambushed in length. And they start to recover from the ambush. And the commanding general, General Wallace, a three-star at the time, says, okay, that's enough. This war game's over. I now know what plan not to use for the invasion of Iraq. I want a new plan by 1600 hours. I want to war game it first thing tomorrow morning. We're not going to do that. And I use that example for a couple of reasons. One, it shows just how powerful war gaming is, but it also shows war gaming's limitation. Because the I was still teaching Air Command Staff College after this happened, and the Army guys were high-fiving each other, and they were really very pleased with this war game because they got 16 days into the campaign in a war game. And you know, and it really helped come up with a much better plan, saved a lot of lives. Well, what percentage of our casualties in Iraq were suffered during the first 16 days? Probably not a very large percentage. And yet they were very proud of themselves going that deep into a campaign. So I also use this case to illustrate why we need to make wargaming better. And then again, why learn the history of wargaming? And I've already covered that. So again, this is the thing, hopefully I'm moving, moving backwards. Okay, so part one of the book, and part one is like 60% of the book. We cover, you know, the different eras within wargaming. The first era is the rise of modern wargaming. And as the good doctor indicated, I make what I hope is a persuasive case that wargames are as old as civilization, that most historians date the start of civilization from the rise of cities. And one of the finalists in the competition for the first city is Ur in Iraq. And they found a wargame in an archaeological dig in Ur. And the Egyptians, and the Chinese, and the Indians, and the Romans, and the Vikings all had these abstract strategy games. But it took until the coming of the Age of Reason and advances in modeling and advances in probability statistics, but to get what we'd call modern wargaming. But part of an advance is opportunity, but part is also need. And the Prussians lost to Napoleon, and they didn't really like that very much. And they went back and they did a post-mortem, and they said, well, the reason why the nation of Frederick the Great lost was we didn't have Frederick the Great. And we need some way to systematically make sure that we may not have a genius born every generation that we need them, but we can have a lot of near geniuses or a lot of people that are trained up. And modern wargaming was part of that effort. It started out the way wargames had always been used for the sons of the kings and emperors and pharaohs. And in very few years, it wound up being used for all the officers. And not only to train them in how to think about wars, but how to look at specific campaigns. And it spread throughout the Prussian armed forces. And if you look at the wars of German unification, Germany shouldn't have won those wars, or Prussia shouldn't have won those wars. You look at the number of troops on the Austrian side versus the Prussian side. You look at the number of troops on the French side versus the Prussian side. You know, it doesn't seem to make sense. And it's not entirely due to wargaming. Wargaming was part of a staff planning process. But still, that played a big part, and that's not Matt Caffrey talking. I went back and looked at documents written at the time, and British authors are saying, you know, the Prussians did this well because of their staff procedures or because of their wargaming. And the French came to the same conclusion, and the Russians came to the same conclusion. In fact, in my much longer talk, I have this chart about when different nations adopted wargaming, and yes, there is a correlation between the year they adopt wargaming and the year they're defeated by Prussia. So it was something that was perceived at the time, and so it really went global. And I talk about how it spread to different nations. Great Britain is really the origin of naval wargaming. This guy by the name of, James or something or another, came up with a war game, and he did supplements to the war game, which evolved into Jane's fighting ships. Started out as like a supplement to his war game, so you could play different ships. In the United States, we had a guy by the name of Livermore, a major at the time, try to get into the U.S. Army. And the chief of staff of the Army at the time, you know, thought that, no, you need to get close to the troops. You don't need all this moving blocks around on maps. And so to try to convince him, Livermore tried to refight Civil War battles and show him, see, it came out the same way. And they didn't come out the same way. And they went back and they looked at it and says, oh, the Prussian tables are based on smoothbore muskets. But we used rifled muskets in the Civil War, which are much more lethal. So they came up with adjustments to the table, reran the Civil War battles, and the Civil War battles turned out the way they did. So, and then a guy in the Navy, our Navy, talking to Captain Combs in the British Navy and talking to Livermore, started wargaming at our Naval War College. The Japanese started doing war games, the Russians started doing war games, and it really became a global phenomenon. Now we get, Now we get into wargaming in the World Wars, some very important wargaming done in the United Kingdom. Here's a good example of how wargames can be reacted to differently. Both Germany and Great Britain did a wargame in 1905. And both assumed that the Germans would swing through Belgium, come around before the British could reach the fight, and crush the French and win the war quickly. And the Germans really liked that outcome. But you Brits didn't really seem that to be too enthusiastic about that outcome. So informal staff discussions with the French, redoing your cross-channel mobilization plan and everything else. And at least in our history books, we're taught one reason there was a Battle of the Marne was that the British Expeditionary Force was in the wrong place at the right time and played a big role in unhinging the German entire effort. Well, that force wouldn't be there that fast if it wasn't for the reforms that were motivated, at least in part, by the outcome of that 1905 war game. So during the interwar periods, war games really played a huge role in the German armed forces. They helped develop what the Germans called mobile operations, what the rest of the world would soon call blitzkrieg. They played a huge role with the United States Navy, figuring out how best to use aircraft carriers. And more than that, figuring out what the major outline would be of the Pacific Theater campaign. And so they realized they would need to seize islands on the way to Japan, so we'd have to start training our Marines in how to do amphibious warfare. Can Marines do that? And then underway replenishment, all these capabilities that take a long time to develop. And then the Marines turned around and started using war games to figure out what they needed to do to really be effective in this amphibious warfare stuff. In fact, there's a moment in our Marine Corps that's famous, but I don't think even very many Marines realize what made it possible. Supposedly some Marines were down in New Orleans and they saw a Higgins boat and they went, that's it, that's what we need. Well, a lot of Marines were like, yeah, we were really smart, we saw that, we knew. Well, why did you know? And it was because war games helped clarify what their requirements were. So when they saw a technology that met that requirement, they realized what they were seeing. So, and then during World War II, we had a big problem in that the Russians wargamed their operations before they conducted them. The Germans did, the British did. We had been using wargaming in our Army and Navy in the interwar period as methods of training our guys in how to fight more effectively. But we didn't teach them how to wargame. So when the war started and our guys graduated from Staff College and they went off to war, lack of evidence doesn't mean evidence that something doesn't exist, but I found like one sentence once in a book about Army commanders in the Western, attack across France, and it said Hodges would always wargame out his operations before he conducted them. He had this lieutenant colonel on his staff that used to do wargaming at the Command and General Staff College, and he used that lieutenant colonel to set up his wargames. And I'm like, oh, shoot. Yeah, of course, they don't. The faculty must know how to do it because they do the war games for the students. So I'm getting off subject a tiny bit. We had your secretary, your minister for defense here 2 days ago, and just unbelievable. I had like 20 seconds to talk to him. And one of the things I said is that, it's really important not just to use war games to teach, but to teach people how to war game. What type of perspective to use when you're getting details from a war game. And a lot of important stuff, too much for the time available, but Germans used war games all through the war, had some major impacts. Japanese and a lot of stuff in that section. Let's see if I can go forward correctly. Yep. Now, when World War II ends, wargaming goes into an eclipse. I had a friend who looked through Naval War College catalogs and just almost no wargaming. I physically went back in the archives and checked Air University catalogs. No wargaming at all. The Army didn't have a war college for a few years, but we won't go into that. Found very little out of Great Britain. Of course, the Germans aren't wargaming anymore. Japanese aren't wargaming anymore. The people who are the Soviet Union, when their country should be spending money on rebuilding hospitals and roads and everything else. They had this huge effort to gather data from the Great Patriotic War that they could use for adjudication of their war games for decades and decades and decades after that. Okay, we start getting into the era of Vietnam, and we start having a recovery of wargaming in the United States. The U.S. Air Force contracts with RAND. RAND does some real breakaway work in wargaming. We reinvent Pall Mall wargaming, which was invented by the Weimar Republic, but we didn't know that. And it really starts to come along, but it's a very small community. And so we discover late in the Vietnam War that the North Vietnamese use a Soviet method of wargaming, which is basically one-move wargaming, where you have a terrain table, both sides come up with their plan, and go away, and the adjudicators figure out what the outcome is and brief them on it. And once we knew that, we had some insights into how to better fight the North Vietnamese and all the rest. Well, again, I only know the data I know, and I don't know if tomorrow I might find more, but I've found two articles on wargaming in Vietnam during Vietnam by the US, and we either did the same thing twice, or there are two articles describing the same event, but a US Army colonel with a PhD in operations research brought over a mini micro PDP-4 or something, you know, this tiny computer, only the size of a refrigerator. And they did a war game in each other area, and the feedback was it was a very good war gaming and very credible and, you know, very, very well researched data. And so which side got more value from war gaming during Vietnam? The North Vietnamese that war gamed every fight, every day, battalion size, regiment size, you know, just every operation being war gamed, you know, it was just scratching in the dirt, but they'd war game it every time. Or the US that had three or six, depending on whether or not both articles are describing the same thing, that had a PhD in charge with cutting edge computer technology and all the rest. Well, I don't know, if you have 100,000 pennies, or you have three $20 pound notes, I probably would go with the pennies. So we're learning from Vietnam, and our Army is saying, you know, we need to make wargaming more accessible, and so they start setting up wargaming things around the Army. You have a promise in performance. When we get into the 80s, a lot more wargaming is being used to come up with operational plans, and a key operational plan they're coming up with is for a contingency of what if there's a fight in the Persian Gulf. And so we talk about war in the sand and the sand tables, and there's several cases where wargames really play a very important part in the prep for and the execution of the first Gulf War, from anticipating the need to pre-position stuff to actual tactics and how we're going to accomplish different things. Probably the high watermark of our wargaming. Well, just as people started copying the Prussians after the Franco-Prussian War, other countries started copying us. And I was teaching wargaming at Air Command Staff College at the time. A lot more international students would sign up for my course after the Gulf War, including one from Bulgaria, and that's close to the time the Cold War was over. It was like, but anyway, and then you get to the point where the Soviet Union collapsed, and we're really into a new era. And I, oh, and by the way, I also have a section of the chapter on just outside of baseball, and I know I'm running short of time, I knew I would. The book took a long time to get published. and there'd be different delays and different delays. So it turned out this colonel I used to work for was now like a SES 3 or something on the joint staff. And I called him up and I said, I've got a couple of months that I didn't think I had. Can I go over with you the things that I'm including in the book and make sure I'm not leaving anything out? He said, well, do you have this? I said, oh, yeah, I have that. He said, do you have this? Yeah, I have that. Well, do you have the time that the Soviet General Staff and the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff played a war game against each other on the breakup of the Soviet Union? And I was like, that's a thing? No, I don't have that. That happened. And so he was able to get me the documents in time to get that into the book. And it's fascinating. And a lieutenant colonel was key to making that happen. And until this book got published, I don't think there was any kind of publicity about just how important that lieutenant colonel's role was. Okay, we get after 9/11, and no wargaming that I can tell, and I think I've known, was done for the operations in Afghanistan, zero, because war games at this time took a while, and things just happened too fast. You know about the war game from the introduction for the preparations to move into Iraq, but again, that was a war game with the conventional part. And so the United States goes into a period where war games, they don't disappear, they don't go into an eclipse, but for years, some of our good friends that are more ops research guys were saying, oh, this human factor stuff, it's unknowable, it's unquantifiable, you can't do it. Well, a lot of what we were doing was human factor stuff. It was winning the peace. And so people said, okay, well, if you guys say you can't do this, then I guess we won't do it. And so some wargaming operations shut down, some kept going just fine with existing budgets, some things got better. Well, a few years ago, the Secretary of Defense sent out this memo that said, we need to innovate more. We're in danger of losing our edge over our adversaries, and so we need to do these four things, and one of the four things was reinvigorate wargaming. Oh, you would think a bomb had gone off. You know, everyone's scrambling around saying, what is this wargaming stuff? And then his deputy, Vice Chief of Staff, Vice Secretary of Defense, comes up with a much longer memo all about wargaming, and another memo all about wargaming, and just a real sea change, and people going into it. And I think it was the Deputy Secretary of Defense used the term atrophy. And so everyone's going, oh, we didn't atrophy here. We're doing all this great stuff. But a lot of push in this area. And one of the few things that, maybe you didn't notice, but the change in administration the last time in the U.S. has been a little bit abrupt. A lot of policies have changed just a bit. One of the only things I'm aware of that didn't, and almost nobody got to stay on. All the senior people had to leave, in many cases very abruptly. The guy who was pushing wargaming stayed on for like 9 months, and it's still being pushed. And so this has been very helpful in the United States. And I talk about, so to conclude the history part, there was another delay, and so I had a little bit of time. And so one evening, I got on my computer and I put into Google, what's the strongest militaries on Earth? And I got like 8 different websites that all listed from 1 to some number. And so, okay, so I start reading the websites to see which I think is most credible. And I pick one, and I come up with the 25 countries that according to the website I picked, has the strongest military. And then for the rest of the evening, I just took the name of the country and the word wargame. And I hit return, and I got multiple articles about initiatives in wargaming, wargaming capabilities, the application of wargaming to this, opening of a new wargaming center, all sorts of stuff on wargaming for 24 of the 25 nations. So the point I want to make wrapping up this section is that whoever your adversary is going to be in the future, whoever your ally is going to be, whoever your coalition partners are going to be, the odds are really good that they wargame. And so it's good to know wargaming. Just there's an old cliche in the U.S., the family that prays together stays together. You know, the coalition that wargames together can get the bugs out of what they're trying to do before young men and women are put in harm's way. And odds are whoever you're allied with does that. So that's the conclusion to the history section. So, which I'm covering here. And, so just as I'm wrapping up, I try to look into the future a little bit, saying what are some of the trends in wargaming, but I conclude by saying, well, okay, this is what we see as trends, but what do we want to see as trends? What do we want wargaming to do? And that's coming up later. So I'm going the wrong way again. So we get to the second part, and the second part's only a third of it, and it's taxonomy of wargaming, that's easy. Utility of wargaming, I try to go through historical cases and show, yes, indeed, here's a case where wargaming was played and actually helped people. Then wargaming advice to people who actually create wargames, wargaming advice to participants, and then a section on wargaming for leaders. You're never going to get to certainty in a wargame, so how do you use the insights you get from there? And the analogy I use is, at least in our armed forces, no intel officer ever gets up in front of a room and says, bad guys are going to do this at 06, 35, and 20 seconds, and they're going to come from this compass bearing, and they're going to do this. They always stand up and say, okay, I have medium confidence in this, I have high confidence, I have low confidence, and I advocate we should accept a procedure like that for wargaming. You're never going to get to complete confidence, because you could do everything right, you could have all the data, you could be doing something easy, you could figure out what the most likely outcome is, and then when the fight actually takes place, a very unlikely outcome occurs. You know, those of you who have wargamed once or twice know that very unlikely outcomes, you know, happen disconcertingly often. And it's the same thing in the real world. Let's not talk about the HMS Hood. So then the final chapter talks a little bit about wargaming and individuals. You know, can wargaming help you be a better parent? Can wargaming help you be more successful in business? Can wargaming help you better understand military history if that's your hobby? And so that's what that chapter covers. And then, I'm going the wrong way again. And then a little bit more detail on each one of these. But I want to get through this quick. And that's some of the different breakdowns that I include. And then the conclusion of the book, and this is something that I kind of developed as I'm writing the book, and one of the motives for doing the book again is to kind of talk about this more throughout the book. But wargames have for a long, long time been trying to get us to win with fewer casualties, less time, less loss of national treasure. Well, if you do it really well, couldn't you get the time to zero, the casualties to zero, the loss of treasure to zero by avoiding wars altogether? And I'm not even suggesting that wargaming can make war obsolete, but doctors don't make death obsolete. You know, none of us are getting out of this alive, but I, for one, really like modern medicine, especially this year. And if wargames can avoid 2% of the wars in the future, wouldn't that be a direction that we would want to move in? And then here's my annexes. As you can see, we talk about wargames that influenced history, a chronology of different things that happened in wargaming different years, wargaming organizations, contributors, contemporary and historical, and then I actually include the memos from the different people who have advocated the increased use of wargaming. So that's all that I have. So what did I learn? You can read this faster than I can say. And what I've also learned is that there needs to be another version of the book. And whether I change the title and make major changes or just call it a second edition, a lot of new stuff has occurred. A lot of old stuff has been discovered. And I'm hoping to get feedback from everybody. So apparently I'm not over my time because my boss has not gotten to me. I got about 5 minutes. So please, 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 as I mentioned in the beginning, first priority is if you know about a war game that was conducted and then something happened after it. Second priority is somebody who really made a big impact on wargaming that maybe doesn't get the credit that they deserve or maybe gets the credit locally, but is known more widely, and then just anything on board gaming. And the final thing is, you know, we covered, you know, wargaming. Let me go back to the, are there any categories to add? Are there any other types of individuals that should get, you know, special singling out at the end as far as how can simulation gaming work? Do I need to cover more technology? Do I need to cover more trends of technology? You know, what else needs to be in there? So very, very little time. Any questions on the book or anything that any of you want to say not on the little index card as or in addition to being on the index card? Yes, sir. Oh, anybody? Well, don't scratch your head. That's dangerous. Yes.
Fantastic talk. Thank you. Your conclusion, I felt, overlapped with H.G. Wells' conclusion at the end of Little Wars.
Yes, where
he says Little Wars may be an end, bring an end to Great War.
Yes.
I was wondering about how the wargaming you can tell the book has overlapped or not overlapped with the rise of recreational wargames in the 60s and 70s.
Very good. Yeah, I cover all that in the book, and I talked about H.G. Wells. In fact, one of the points I make in the conclusion is, and you know, Wells published that book in 1913, and it was, you know, this may stop wars. So at the very least, that's premature. But was it premature? Was he, you know, he talked about flying machines and a lot of other stuff. Was H.G. Wells just ahead of his time yet again? So that's a very good point, something I make sure to include. Now, as you're leaving, I hope to have more copies, but let me cover this to make sure. I have two copies. I promised my wife to carry neither of them home on the airplane. I told somebody I was going to save a copy for him, but he's not here. And there's eight that I'm sure is going to arrive at Phil Sabin's office about 20 minutes after we break up. So I'm selling these for what I pay for them, plus airfare, so they all have the same amount. And it's, I forget what the conversion of pounds are, but I can look it up. And so whoever gets to me first. And then anyone else who wants it, say what? Anybody else just will have to see Phil. And we were told it should be here like 3 days ago. So
just divide by
currency. Oh yeah, in pounds it's 37 pounds, 71 pence. And that's both what I paid for in
the other one. 38 pounds would be the easy one.
Okay, or 38 pounds, or whatever you want to do. And again, these two before they disappear, and then for the same price, the other eight that Phil's getting. So I wanted to make sure I brought that up before people departed. Any other comments? Anything that you would want to see in the future? Yes?
It's just asking that list about those objectives. It's a bit about connection to the conference, but politicians, group governments,
yes.
Those other organizations.
Yes. Yes. If I understand, so what you're saying is not just military members, but like civil servants and... I think that's very good. Yeah, because a lot of times people get put in charge of stuff and they have no background in it. And it really does help. Tom, if I have 45 more seconds for an anecdote, I'll answer questions instead. I'll tell you the anecdote that way. Yes.
Who's publishing the book, please?
It's published by the Naval War College Press. If you don't want to spend however many pounds that was, it's free download. It's been downloaded like 4,700 and something times. Now, I try hard to pretend I'm modest. But one day at lunch, the guy I was meeting was late, and I checked to see how many times it had been downloaded. And then just out of boredom, I started checking all the other titles. And the other 43 titles in the Newport Press series had at that time been downloaded just over 2,000 times, all of them added together. So this is doing insanely well. One of the big problems was you couldn't get a print copy of it because it went out of print in 15 days. Government printing office tries to guess the size of the print run, so it doesn't run out for the first 2 years and doesn't linger more than a few years after that, and 15 days. So, do I have to say thank you and see you later, or one more question? I think it's thank you. Hey, guys, thank you.
Thank you.
You can get emails.